Hey there, my name's Doug Bird and welcome to Something Fresh, where we talk to adventurers, athletes and progressive thinkers. On this show, we aim to create an environment where you, the listener, can escape, explore and learn through interesting people who've achieved great things. The idea is to help people grow, become inspired and through that, encourage them to take that first step towards doing something about it. If that's not up your alley and you're simply here to listen to interesting conversations, then that's cool too. Thanks for tuning in. Now's the time to sit back, relax, and enjoy the journey.
So, Brian Kapper, can you believe it? I've managed to get you onto a podcast. Not that it was all that hard, though, because you're just generally a very enthusiastic guy who loves to chat to everybody, but absolute privilege and an honor to have you on the show. As I've said in the build-up to this podcast, you're an absolute legend of motorsport here in South Africa. So to have you here on Wild Eight TV makes me very happy, BC. How are you going in Joburg?
Yeah, man, all's good, and really excited to be on the podcast. I've seen some of the other boys are on, and it's made me a little bit jealous. So I must say, I'm pretty stoked and happy to be on it. So thank you for having me.
So BC, obviously, if you don't mind me calling you that, for those of you that don't know, BC Brian Kapper and BCR Brian Kapper Racing. All of these acronyms you'll learn in the next hour and a half, more give or take. But how are you coping with Corona, bro?
Doug, I must say it's been awesome. You know, I think for an athlete, it's maybe not too much different, other than obviously we just can't travel anymore. But I mean, really, my day-to-day life hasn't really changed. I'm still getting up in the morning. I'm still training. I still go to bed at the same time. Yep, I may watch a little bit more TV and doing a little bit more research on things and, you know, reading a book, a little bit more books and stuff like that. But in general, I mean, it's not like I'm now having to stay at home. You know, I'm home a lot of the time anyway, other than traveling. So, you know, when I am home, this feels exactly the same. So I must say, it hasn't really affected me. But it's obviously weird to see all the other people in my estate being home, which is quite weird because they're normally at work.
So the one thing that has always amazed me about you, Brian, is you've had such a long and illustrious and successful career. And you're now kind of at the point where you've done it all for the most part. How do you stay motivated to keep on training? Because I had a little sneak peek at your Instagram earlier on. And as you say, you certainly at home isn't slowing you down. You're still training. Looks like you're in beast mode there.
Absolutely. You know, I've been a fitness freak all my life, but I never really knew how to hone it and make it the perfect skill or the perfect way. And I've learned now how to eat properly. I've learned how to train properly. I'm listening to my body now, whereas when I was younger, I would just wing it, you know, and just when I was tired, I just keep training through it. And, you know, thankfully I had trainers through the years, so they would help me with that. But in general, I just did what it took. Whereas now I'm a lot more in tune with my body. I'm a lot more in tune with what I eat. I haven't touched meat or chicken since last year, December. And so that's made a huge difference for me. It's quite a controversial thing. I don't advertise that. Certainly not at gatherings and things, because it's so controversial. Not that I give a rip what anybody thinks anyway, but honestly, it's changed my whole life. I don't eat at all. I don't eat any meat or chicken, and that's made a huge impact on me. But to stay motivated, to be honest, Doug, I love giving the lighties a hiding, man. The guys are at the top of their game, and I still believe in my heart of hearts and in my mind that I'm as good as them. I'm a little older than them now, you know. So it's a mindset. I believe that I'm, you know, I've got much more experience. Yep, they might have a little bit more in the tank, you know. They are much younger and they're willing to take bigger risks for sure. But I guess, I don't know, I don't see myself at the age that the number is. I see myself as one of them still.
In terms of what prompted the decision, I mean, you and I have known each other for quite some time now. And I will say, there was a very visible, noticeable change in terms of your body weight and so on. It's not the case that you were ever overweight. You were always a really fit person, as you say, prioritizing fitness. But at one point, I remember going, cheap as BC, you've like, looks like you're in more of a focused training mode than ever, and had ideas that it might have been linked to a more refined diet potentially. But what prompted the decision to make such a big adjustment?
Doug, if I'm very honest with you, I was in Mauritius in December last year, and there was a monsoon or whatever on at the time, and I watched the movie Game Changers, and so many people told me not to watch it because it's, you know, it's so controversial and very one-sided. But I just, and again, I hope no one thinks any bad of me for saying this, but I'm not particularly an animal lover. So I didn't do the no meat or chicken thing from an animal loving point of view. I just didn't, it didn't make sense to me that they were pumping hormones into all these animals and I was eating it. And I was a huge chicken eater. I'm not joking. You cannot believe how much chicken I used to eat. Nando's was, I should have been sponsored by them. But, you know, I loved a good steak. I loved biltong. I honestly believed that I needed a lot more protein. But I watched the movie and I don't know what made me do it. I just decided there and then, you know, I wanted to be healthier. I wanted to live longer. I want to be around my kids for longer. I just want to be better. And I thought, what have I got to lose? I'm going to give it a go and just cut it right there. I decided that day, and everybody in the family said, I don't know, they didn't say it, but they may have thought it was, yeah, we'll see how long this lasts, because they knew how much I loved meat and chicken. And man, I just decided there and then, that was it. And it's been a good 4 months now, and I feel on top of the world. You know, going back to what you were saying about me never really being overweight, I felt like I was overweight at times, but I've always been healthy. I've always trained very hard, and that's kind of been my get out of jail free card. As I've just trained harder. So whenever I ate badly, I would just train harder the next day. But I realized that if I could train harder and be eating correctly, man, I'd be living a cleaner lifestyle, a cleaner way of living.
It's quite incredible if you think about that in terms of the positive impacts on your life. And we'll unpack that in just a little bit. But I guess I could also put myself into the category, and there's some friends or people that have been close to me that have had untimely deaths, that have been fit people, that have generally always been active, and they've competed in their sportive codes at the highest level. And then, you know, after a session, literally lying on the couch and having a heart attack and dying. And you look into that, and I think you hit the nail on the head there, where you were saying, you know, you eat whatever you want, you just trained harder, but you can't see what's happening in your bloodstream. You can't see what's happening physiologically beneath skin level unless you are seeing physicians on a regular basis and getting your blood levels tested. I don't know, maybe it's clutching at straws here, or a step too far, or perhaps unfounded to think or even say, but I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, I mean, if I look at myself as well, and in terms of the sports that I've enjoyed, I'm very much the same as you in that I've eaten whatever I want. For the most part, I still eat whatever I want, and I just go a bit harder when I'm riding my bike, or I paddle a bit harder if I'm in my boat, and that kind of keeps the weight off. But it almost gives you that illusion that you're healthy, when in actual fact, you're actually not. Your engine's pretty dirty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just going back to that, I always relate it to my sport. And, you know, at the pinnacle of my supermoto career, man, if you were running the wrong fuel, you weren't even in the same race. You were in another class altogether. And so, you know, oil, fuel, anything that makes the bike run, you know, you've got to keep putting the right stuff in. And I honestly wish that I'd known that 15, 20 years ago. I just think of how much, you know, how much better I would have been, how much faster I would have been, how much more I could have dominated and prolonged my career even longer, you know. But listen, better late than never. And I honestly feel like I am putting the right things in now.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Well, respect to you. I haven't managed to clean up my diet that much, but one thing I have done is stop drinking. Been off the booze since, well, when I say been off the booze, I used to probably have about two beers a day, maybe. And that's part of like the riding culture that I'm in now, mountain biking, cruise up, ride hard for an hour and a half, riding some great trails, get down to bootleggers, have a beer or two with the guys and head home. And you don't realize how it actually affects your sleep patterns and how your sleep affects almost everything else in your life. And having kids, it was just, you know, started to get more and more tired, and cutting booze was pretty cool. I've had two beers since then, but it's been more on my terms, not really a socially driven thing. It's more been because I've actually just felt like a beer and I've had one. But what's your views on the beers? Are you also off them completely, or have been for a while?
Doug, I've never really been a big drinker. So, you know, that's never really been a big thing for me. But I've got a hell of a sweet tooth, and I love nothing more than I crave it after a ride. I just crave that sweet taste of a Savannah Dry or a Hunter's Dry, you know. And I cannot tell you how much I crave that. And after a hard day's training or riding, I love just getting home at, you know, it was 5 or 6 or whatever, and just having an ice cold Savannah. You know, maybe I'll have a second one, but to be honest, again, I'm just trying to. I mean, I've lost 6 kilos so far, just eating right and training right, and I'm just trying to tighten up everywhere. And I've actually just now stopped all the, I don't want to say beers. I've never drank beer before, but the Savannahs and the Hunter's Dries, and I've moved onto red wine now. More of a just a little, you know, sociable thing, and they say it is an antioxidant. So, you know, I drink a lot more water than I used to. I really do hammer the water in during the day. I'm up to like 4 liters a day. I have 1 or 2 coffees a day. But as I say, I'm trying to get on to, you know, just a glass of red wine at night now. I'm not a big drinker at all. I'm quite the goon and the geek when it comes to drinking. I'm all or nothing, and when it's all, it's not a pretty sight. So I'd rather not do it.
Yeah, I think it's weird. I think it's mostly a sportsman's thing, to be honest, because, you know, as an athlete, you're so focused all the time. You don't have the opportunity in your busy training schedule, and you're focused to achieve results at events that you, as you say, might have like 1 or 2 drinks during the week, and it's just for a pleasure perspective. But then when it's the after party and time to celebrate the win, generally every athlete I've ever known at an after party, the wheels generally fall off.
Yeah, and wheels being the operative.
Yeah, for sure, 100%. All righty, well, we jumped straight into a part of the conversation that I kind of planned for later on, but that's all good, man. I love the fact that it's just dynamic and it's moving. But Brian, we definitely want to be talking about your journey within the motorsports world here in South Africa and around the world, because it is a fascinating one, and it is, I would argue, probably one of the most successful in terms of lifespan that you've managed to be at the top of your game for a very, very long time. So with that in mind, where did you develop the love for the sport, and how did it all start for you?
Doug, it's a story that I haven't told many people from the word go, but, you know, the bottom line is that I've always been fascinated with racing cars, racing bikes, anything with an engine. And my dad got me a bike when I was 8, 9 years old. And, you know, we used to watch it on TV, and eventually got a bike and just socially rode. You know, I never had the opportunity to really go and race, you know, nearly at a professional level, but just rode and really just loved the feeling of being free on the bike. I was never really a big team sports player. I played all the team sports, but I really excelled at tennis, you know, individual sports, tennis, swimming. I was never really a great team player. So soccer, cricket, rugby were never really interesting to me. And the bike thing was all me, you know, it was up to me. Once I was on the bike, that's all that, you know, it was up to me. And so got a bike and started riding, and I'll fast forward the story a little bit, but rode a couple of enduros and motocross races, 9, 10 years old. And then at the age of 11, was watching TV with my dad one day, and the sport of trail biking came on. And I'd had a pretty big crash on a motocross track probably a month before watching the trials event, and really scared the living daylights out of me. It scared me bad when I had this big crash, cut my whole mouth open, my whole chin open. And I didn't like the butterfly effect that I got in my stomach prior to a race. Anyway, saw this trial thing on TV, and actually used to ride at a motocross track where a guy that used to ride trials used to ride at. And he was never allowed to ride a motocross bike, and I'd never ridden a trials bike. And so we swapped bikes. He would ride my bike, I would ride his. And again, cut a long story short, I just fell in love with the sport. I could ride this bike and do things that I couldn't do on my motocross bike. And for me, one of the coolest things that I ever saw guys do was pop a wheelie. And I jumped on this bike, and I could wheelie the bike, I don't know, maybe 10 or 12 meters, which was huge for me at the time. And eventually got this guy to come over to my house and showed my dad what this was all about. And my dad watched and said, well, geez, you know, if you really like this, why don't you give it a go? And so we got a bike, And that was it, really. I started trail biking, and you know, the sport is nowhere near as intimidating as motocross or enduro. You know, you're not coming 40 of you into a corner at once. It's an individual sport. You're riding in a controlled environment in a section on your own. The speeds were a lot lower, so I liked that at the age of 11 years old. Did that for I'd say about 7, 8, 9 years. Won a South African championship. And then I went and rode in the AMA trial championship in the States. All my competitors went over to Europe and raced in Spain and the UK. But the two biggest problems that they always had was, of course, the weather and the language barrier, obviously, in Spain. And so my dad and I decided, let's give it a go by going to the States. And he bought me an old Winnebago motorhome. I mean, you couldn't have scripted it better. It was like out of a movie. Whenever you see those Winnebago motorhomes, that's the exact one that I drove around in America. And started off in New York, in town, I'm just hitting a blank now, but in Connecticut. And basically drove all the way down the coastline down to Daytona Bike Week. Spent a week in Daytona Bike Week, and then started the national championship. The first round was in Daytona. And in Florida, and did the whole trials championship. Finally got to the second last round of the championship and got offered. I was racing independently. I was riding on my own. And at the second last round of the championship, I got offered a ride from Factory Honda, which is Montesi in the States, which is Honda backed. And really, that was my dream, was to get a factory ride. But the only problem was, by the time I'd gotten to that point, I was completely burnt out. I didn't love the sport anymore. I was homesick. I didn't want to be in the States anymore. I just wanted to come home. And I got offered this ride and actually turned it down, believe it or not. And it's a fine line, because when I turned it down, I was obviously back in South Africa and started my trial show. A guy by the name of Jeff Aaron in the States gave me the right to start an extreme riding exhibition trial bike show in South Africa. And I started that and actually stopped riding competitive trials. And at that time, I was sponsored by a company called GasGas, which is a trial bike manufacturer, but they started making enduro bikes. And they put a huge enduro team together, off-road and enduro team, and two of their top riders got injured. And at that time, the guy needed to fill in riders, and he got Wayne Smith, a motocross champion, and myself to fill in for, I think it was Daryl Curtis and Rion Fanikuk, who were injured at the time, or Errol Dalton, I can't remember. And I went to my first off-road race in Swaziland, and I'd never ridden off-road. It was brand new to me. And I'll never forget, Alfie Cox passed me in the time trial. I thought, oh, well, this is no problem. I'll just hook onto him. And, you know, he was normally top three. And I thought, hey, I'll be in the game. Anyway, needless to say, I followed him for about 2 or 3 kilometers and crashed my brains out. And that was my introduction to off-road and enduro racing.
So in terms of your trials, though, because I want to take a step back there before we move into the enduro aspect of it. I remember as a kid, jeepers, I couldn't have been more than 12 or 13 years old, going down into the Valley of 1,000 Hills just outside of Pietermaritzburg. My dad took me to watch Brian Kappa taking on the boys, and you guys were hopping between rocks and in the river and out the river on the banks of the Umsumduzi. I mean, your career, obviously, as you said there, started really young. I think I then went to watch you take part in another trial event that was up near the back of Pietermaritzburg, near Sweetwaters area. I remember it being quite a big open, like it was perhaps an old sand mine. In terms of your exposure to the sport on a local level, of course, it wouldn't have been that of what was happening globally. How did you upskill yourself to become a better rider? Because for the most part, and I'm guessing here, there wouldn't have been too many mentors ahead of you in South Africa, in particular when it comes to trials, to teach you how to do stuff. Like, how did you figure it all out?
Let me just clarify something quick, Doug. I'm not sure if you were saying you were 12 or 13 or I was 12 or 13, because if it was me at 12 or 13, I can promise you the guys weren't coming out to see me ride.
No, I was 12 or 13.
No, it's funny you say that, because my dad and I really took this thing seriously. You know, and my goal was always to try and ride the world championship or compete against the best in the world. And we wanted to fast track this thing, and we figured what would be the quickest way to gain experience. And as you know, from any sporting or professional point of view, there's no time like saddle time. And the best saddle time is in the race. And I think that goes for any sport. And we decided to, I mean, I've been Joburg based. I grew up in Joburg, lived in Joburg all my life. And we decided to compete in the Natal Trials Championship, which is obviously KwaZulu-Natal now. And so one weekend we would ride trials in Joburg. The following weekend we would ride trials in Natal and vice versa. So we doubled up on all the exposure that we could get in terms of competition. And so exactly what you're saying, I wrote all the events down in KZN. But certainly in the beginning stages, there were a couple of guys better than me. But, you know, I say my dad and I because we did this as a team. But I progressed so quickly in the beginning at a young age that, yeah, there weren't many people better than me. There was a guy that gave me a real hard time that lived in East London, a guy by the name of Mark Fox. And yeah, obviously living in East London, I couldn't learn from him. So the only time I could ever really learn was in competitions. So yeah, I mean, in the beginning, it was watching old trials videos, VHS trials videos, or even beta videos, I think back in those days. I just exposed myself to as many competitions as possible. And as I say, we rode nationals, we rode the KZN Championship and the Transvaal Championship in those days, which is obviously now Gauteng Championship.
And in terms of access to gear and bikes and all those kinds of things, because, I mean, it is a niche sport nowadays. I'd imagine it would have been in even more of a niche sport back in those days as well. Was it quite easy to come across the bikes and equipment that you needed to not only compete, but also to train?
Yeah, believe it or not, Doug, it was actually bigger back then than it is now, sadly. Obviously the prices of the bikes have just skyrocketed now, just like anything. I mean, you look at a bicycle, it's more expensive than a motorbike these days. But, you know, in those days, I always rode a one-year-old bike. So whatever the national champion the year before rode, I would ride his bike the next year for the first two or three years of my the beginning days of trials. There were guys that brought in Montesa trials bikes was one of the biggest ones. There was Beta at the time, one or two smaller ones, but those were the two big ones. And yeah, we had access to bikes pretty readily. There was an Alpine Star importer at the time that brought in the trials boots, because obviously it's completely different to a motocross boot. And then obviously we rode in open face helmets, and those were fairly we had access to them. The guys used to go over, the top guys, you know, before I got to the top, used to go over and do what was called the Scottish 6-day trial, which is actually on my bucket list, believe it or not. It's a 6-day event in Scotland. And when the guys would come back from that event, they'd bring, you know, a bag full of helmets and boots back. And, you know, we would often buy from those guys. So, yeah, I mean, we had access to that stuff, you know, pretty easily.
In terms of your progression then across to enduro racing, as you say, they're hanging on to a guy like Alfie Cox. I mean, we've got some incredible motorsport talents that have come out of South Africa. Yourself, Alfie Cox, Shaniel de Villiers, amongst many others, a new generation, the likes of Brad Binder and so on. It's incredible to see how South Africans over the decades have managed to put their hands up. But you're talking about enduro racing now and moving into that space by accident almost. Was that something that you felt added a lot of value to your career?
Absolutely. You know, there's a time and a place for everything. And at the time, I was ready to get my... I wanted to get that adrenaline out. I was 18 or 19 years old. I was, you know, I'd hit, you know, the hormones were going crazy. And now I had the skill to be able to go and do the I don't want to say gnarlier sports, because by no means is trials not a gnarly sport. But, you know, it's not as aggressive. It's not as in your face. It's not as hectic. It's a much more controlled sport. Whereas off-road, motocross, and enduro is, man, it's wide open all the way. And I'd now gotten to the point where I wanted that now. I thrived on that, you know, that butterfly feeling in my stomach and that adrenaline rush that you get coming into the first corner when there's 40, 50 guys next to you and you've got to get there first. So, you know, from that point of view, I was ready for it. And unfortunately, I came in with probably way too much exuberance. And injuries play such a huge part in any sport, but certainly in our sport. And I had more injuries in 1.5 years of trying to tackle this new sport of enduro and off-road than I've had in the rest of my 20-year career. So unfortunately, that played a huge, huge role in my career. But in saying that, it also opened up another door, and I'm probably jumping the gun a little bit now, but it opened the door to supermoto racing, which really set me onto much bigger things. That's really, I think, what gave me a big name was my career into supermoto.
Well, supermoto in South Africa, I mean, that Mr. Price series was massive. I mean, cheapest, I would say, for probably a decade. The sport was just growing from strength to strength. Why do you think that was? I mean, it certainly wasn't the novelty of it, because for me, if it was a novelty, it would have worn off after 2-3 years. But it looked like a really nice hybrid of on-off-road, where people that came from different backgrounds had a real crack at doing quite well in it. What was kind of the real draw to that sport for you as a rider?
I'll be honest, you know, the thing that attracted most people at the time, certainly, and it really went crazy in about 2005 or 2006, actually, was our biggest year, I think, when, like you say, that Mr. Price series was, the Supermoto series was just massive. I mean, we had street races at the casino down in Durban on the main drag down there, the Marine Parade or whatever it is. You know, we had the Pinetown Street Race, which we had 25,000 people at. We had serious, serious numbers coming to our events. And I think what attracted people was I certainly don't want to say it was safer, because it by no means was safe. I mean, there have been a couple of deaths, unfortunately, in it, like any motorsport. But I think the fact that it was a more controlled environment than racing at 160 k's an hour through the bush and not knowing what's coming, that just made absolutely no sense to me. I'll tell you what the biggest thing really probably was for most of us, was that you could actually see what was going on now. You know, when you went to an enduro or an off-road race, the rider would leave at 8 a.m. and come back 3 hours later after a lap, then refuel and go out for another 3 hours, then refuel and go out for another 3 hours. It is the dumbest sport in the world in terms of value. It made absolutely no sense, but I was flipping good at it. So I had to keep doing it, you know. When supermoto came along, I was even better at that than I was at the enduro and off-road. And I was like, geez, man, I'm going to do this where I can make a lot more money, because it's the viewership is bigger. It had TV coverage and I wasn't going to get hurt. You know, every time I got on the off-road bike or enduro bike, I wouldn't say every time, but every second or third time I was on the ground. Where supermoto, I was really good at it from early on, thank goodness. And you know, I wasn't getting hurt every second week. So it really came at the right time. You know, guys like Alfie Cox that really had retired from the sport of Dakar and off-road racing, and you know, he was racing cars at the time, but he could get on one of his bush bikes and put a set of supermoto wheels on, and he could go and have a good time with all his old buddies, you know, Gary Galway, Gary Peterson, all the big names of motorsport were all getting attracted to the sport. You know, it was the fastest form of growing motorsport in the world at one stage. And I just happened to jump on this thing. I mean, I always say to people, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time throughout my career. And while we're doing this talk right now, I see that as a blessing and a curse in many ways. And the blessing was I really was in the right place at the right time. I mean, they needed a rider in that Gas team. I switched over to off-road and enduro. I got injured in that sport and supermoto came along and I just happened to get a ride at the time. I think the curse side of it comes in, and I don't know if I'm jumping the gun here on this whole thing, is that I was fairly good at all of them instead of really good at just one of them. You know, so a Brad Binder is ridiculous at road racing. He's a pretty good motocross rider and probably could ride a trials bike, but I was better than what those guys were at all the sports, but not immaculate at one of them like he is at MotoGP, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, it definitely does make sense. But in terms of your career locally, there's not many, well, there aren't any that have been as successful as you have across the board. That is without a shadow of a doubt. But in terms of supermoto and moving from enduro to supermoto, What were the fundamental changes in bikes that you had to contend with? Because I'd imagine that, I mean, the braking systems on the supermoto bike seem to be bigger and much more powerful. I'd imagine that your acceleration would also need to be fine-tuned to be as powerful as you can out of corners. And also, you know, you're moving from enduro where you've got full off-road tires to now you're essentially riding slicks, but you've also got these like whoop and jump sections off-road in supermoto. How long did that transition take for you to get used to essentially a new sport?
Well, to answer that straight away, I do want to go into the technicalities of the bike for you just so you can understand that, because you made a valid point. But just how quick did I adapt? Man, I'll be honest with you. The first time I raced a supermoto race, my teammate, Lawrence Mahoney at the time, who's obviously a phenomenon in the off-road and enduro scene, four-time Roof of Africa winner. I mean, he's a legend in terms of off-road and enduro. But he something happened to him, and he got asked to come and race this supermoto race. And I had a broken wrist at the time, funny enough, from an enduro or an off-road. I can't remember at the time, but I just had some pins put in my wrist. And he was testing for GasGas at the time on the supermoto track. And I just watched him riding. And, you know, he was probably top five or top six at the time. And I watched him ride. And I was like, no way, man. I know that I can ride one of these things better than that. And I actually ended up getting him to take his suit off, and I jumped on the bike, and with a broken wrist I went 2.5 seconds a lap faster or something like that, and I was double his weight. I was much bigger than him. So I think I managed to be able to understand the grip on the tar, transitioning from the tar onto the dirt with the slick tires. I don't know. I guess I had a really good feel for it, and you know, you can't buy that experience or that feel. And to be honest, where did I get that? I guess that came from riding enduro or trials and enduro and off-road, and just having that fine feel for what's underneath you. You know, a very good friend of mine, Richard Roots, races cars, car racing, circuit racing. And he always said to me when he was coaching me and teaching me how to drive high-performance cars, he would always say, you can feel it in your bum. You know, you feel the car moving underneath you, you know, in your seat. And I don't really know how to put that into terms on the bike, but I would feel the same type of, you know, explaining it in the same way. You've either got that feel or you don't have that feel. And I had it straight away from day one. The very first day I rode a super motorbike, I had that fine feel for the tar and the dirt.
So, I mean, the one thing that has always amazed me about your career as well is that you've always been working with some really great brands. You've been part of some really strong team setups. But when did it really change gear for you as a rider in terms of, I mean, everyone ultimately, I guess not everyone, that's a generalization, but I would argue that many people see getting a Red Bull lid or a Monster lid or something of that level in your career is when you know you really started to make an impact. When did things change gear for you? We've talked a lot about your riding, as I said, but from a sponsorship perspective, where was your big year? Where did it kick off?
So that's a brilliant question, because it's such a huge role in any sport, but certainly in our sport. You know, I would probably say, funny enough, my first big sponsor prior to Red Bull was the Hyundai Corporation. They I was traveling around the country doing these extreme riding trial bike shows, and didn't have a vehicle to tow this monster of a rig that I used to set up at all the events and shows. And so they gave me a Hyundai panel van. And it was honestly the coolest thing for me to get sponsored by these guys, because every time a new model came out, they'd asked me to drive it for 3 months. And I felt like a rock star, man. I was 19 years old, being given free cars. And then, yeah, I mean, definitely when Red Bull approached me, It took me to a whole new level. I was then able to, and who knows how I did this, because I have no degree in terms of marketing or anything like that. I've just really done it by trial and error. But after being with Red Bull for, I don't know, I guess 3, maybe 4 years, I learned how powerful the brand was, and I was able to leverage other sponsors through the Red Bull platform. And so, you know, like you say, I've been very, very fortunate with being with big corporate companies. And, you know, I was in the right place at the right time. And at the time I signed with a company called National Mobile, and they put the deal together. I was racing for KTM at the time, but they'd signed a very good friend of mine, Gray Dick, up but he was racing for Yamaha already. And so I raced for National Mobile and Yamaha the following year. But after that, I signed with KTM for a multi-year contract, which spanned 9 years. So I was with KTM for 9 years. I've been with Red Bull for 19 years this year. Mercedes-Benz for almost 11 years now. All my sponsors, honestly, I've been with them. I don't think I've been with a sponsor for less than, I think the sponsor that I've been the least amount of time with is 7 or 8 years. So, you know, loyalty is a huge thing. But I went through a little bit of a stage at one point in my career where I was riding with products that I didn't really believe in. And I'll never forget the day that I changed my knee brace sponsor at the time. I was getting paid a pretty good salary from these guys, but I was going through these things like chewing gum. And I decided there and then, I said, this is the day that I'm going to choose to ride the equipment that I really believe in and that I'm going to win it, even if it means I take a salary knock. And that was the best thing I could have done, because now I really believed in the products that I was using. And that made a huge difference for me. But to answer your question, I'd probably say the point that made a huge difference for me was when I signed with Red Bull and KTM. Those were my two pretty big benchmarks. And I would say for sure Mercedes-Benz as well. Those are big companies, corporate brands that have really, I've been able to leverage those brands to get other sponsors.
Well, what's also pretty incredible in this whole process is that you've managed to have relationships with these brands for the periods of time that you've talked about. And to be honest, it's completely uncommon in the sport of world, be it motorsport, traditional mainstream sport, because of relevance. I mean, brands will say, okay, cool, well, we've partnered with this person for 3 to 5 years and we've got what we need and we'll move on. But also a lot of the time is athletes, in my view, make the mistake of building their brands solely on the performances that they can deliver. Now, this is something that I'm actually really passionate about and something that I'm keen to explore with you a little bit further. But my view on things is that now more than ever, athletes need to focus on developing what they can control. And something that you can't control is performance. Sure, you can control your training environment. You can control your nutrition. You can control your coaching setup. You can control all of those types of things. But when it comes to racing, you really have no control. It might be bad weather. You might have a mechanical. You might have a crash. Someone might just be better than you. But if you've sold yourself into a brand as someone that is consistently going to be able to achieve podium positions so that media is interested in you, so that media talks about you, it's a very unbalanced value proposition in my mind, because I would never, in the business sense, develop a business that would be lopsided to favor only one of my strengths. You've almost been ahead of your time in many respects, because not only have you focused on racing Brian Kapper and achieving good results, but you've balanced that out with your performances in the riding exhibition and shows. So where potentially your performances might have been down due to injury or whatever it might have been, your shows have been able to keep you relevant and keep you out there at things like Top Gear festivals and many other festivals around South Africa. Was that a very deliberate decision, or did it just kind of happen as you grew as an athlete and as a rider?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, I'm so big on this that things happen for a reason, and that was definitely not planned. My plan was to come back from the States and not compete anymore. I didn't want anything to do with competition anymore. I'd burnt myself out completely. But, you know, something about trials is that it's all about how smooth and how perfect you can get through a section of obstacles. But whenever there was a huge rock step on the left-hand side of where we were supposed to go, and there were, man, even if there were five people there, I would go up the rock step because I was a show-off. And, you know, that just, I lost so many competitions. I could have probably won a national championship 3-4 years prior to me winning it if I just focused on the actual sport and not trying to be a hero. And when I tasted, I mean, I did a show at the Nassau Coliseum in New York in front of 60,000 people. The day I tasted that, you know, the fact that I was being paid and I wasn't being judged on my performance, I was just trying to wow the crowd, that changed everything for me. And that gave me the idea to bring back this, you know, this concept or the show and show people what my sport is all about in South Africa. And so I honestly think that I'm probably more of an entertainer, you know, than a racer. Although again, now my racing was able to entertain people. So it again, the off-road and the enduro made no sense because I couldn't entertain people. where Supermoto, motocross to a point, I was able to entertain people. And that's, like you say, I was really fortunate. You know, you were saying that these guys are based only on their results. Man, that is dangerous. You know, you look at a guy like Wade Young. I know he was on your show last week. He's just, that guy is an animal, man. He is a phenomenon. But he is on the limit all the time. He's on the line of fire every single week. And thank God for his sake, he's staying healthy, man. But a guy like me, I was crashing every second week. So I was really fortunate to be able to fall back on the fact that I had this amazing show that I could travel around with, and my sponsors loved that.
Yeah, I mean, geez, and in terms of your exhibition riding, how many years have you been up to that now? I mean, geez, you must have, if you look at the collective of people that have watched you riding in exhibitions, it's got to be in the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I would like to believe that. You know, now with, you know, in the last 4 years, I would say, the international shows have really gone crazy. You know, I'm doing a lot of shows in the UAE now, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, Kuwait, Oman, Dubai. So, you know, those shows, the numbers are big now, you know. So I don't know how many people I've entertained over the years, but I certainly have been very fortunate. I've like I say, I've been in the right place at the right time, and I've been very, very fortunate. I've had a really, really fortunate career.
Well, BC, right time, right place. But as Gary Player once said, I hope I'm not misquoting here. Was it him? He said, the more I practice or the harder I train, the luckier I get.
Yep, you're 100% correct. That was him. Yep.
So I think that's also more of what it is on your side of things there. In terms of some of your more like crazy achievements, so, I mean, you won 9 national supermoto titles. You race supermoto in the US. You're 11-time national champion here. Of course, we just talked about your extreme riding exhibitions that you still enjoy, but you've also done some pretty crazy stuff, man. Looking through it all, South African record for the motocross, it's a long jump record, 21 cars. Like, what on earth possessed you to give that type of stunt a go?
Yeah, that's a good question, man, and I certainly wouldn't do it in these days. But at the time, there was a, and I'm sure you would have known this well, there was a show that used to travel around the country called the Bigfoot Monster Truck Show.
Yep, definitely remember that.
Yep, there was a guy by the name of Ian Soans. And crazy, crazy story. It's such a fine line in everything in life. But my folks were actually at the Rand show 1 year and saw this show. And, you know, I was just riding trials at the time. I mean, there was no talk of shows or racing or anything like that. I was just competing in national trials competitions. And I think it was my mom, I stand to be corrected, my mom or my dad walked up to Ian Soans at the end of the show and said, hey, man, you've got to have our kid, you know, Brian, in your show. And certainly I was no one back then, man. I think I was 15 or 16 years old. I was a kid. And they said, nah, you've got to have this kid in your show. And he, so cool of him, said, well, let him come, you know, an hour before the show tomorrow. Let's see what he can do. And if he's any good, I'll put him in the show. Anyway, cut a long story short, we arrived the next day at the Rand Showgrounds in near Soweto there, near FNB Stadium. And I jumped onto the wheel of the monster truck, jumped across the gap and jumped off. And that was it. He loved that and he put me in the show. And one of the things in the show was a guy by the name of Dylan Smith, who's actually a good friend of mine, used to jump a motocross bike, an RM250 Suzuki, over cars. And depending on how big the stadium was, he would jump 14, 15, 16 cars. You jump over the cars. The danger or the difficult thing about it, or the stupidity of it, was that it was a jump that was, I don't know, I guess 11 meters long, 12 meters long, probably 6 foot high, but no landing. So you'd jump and jump 30, 40, 50 meters sometimes and land on flat ground. I mean, we were jumping high. We were jumping 4 or 5 stories high at a time. And you'd land on flat ground. Anyway, again, long story short.
That's sorry to be jumping there, but landing to flat, that's insanity. And back then, I don't imagine the suspension on an RM250 would be all that solid.
Well, it wasn't as good as they are these days, but it was actually, you know, it was as good as they were at the time. You know, I mean, I guess it's the same as, I mean, looking, I don't know if the technology in the boats now that you guys race down the doozy with have technologically changed so much. But, you know, certainly the bikes nowadays are better. But the bottom line is that it was a dumb thing to do. there was no sense whatsoever in it. But that's what records are there for, to be broken. And I was with the team or with the show for, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 months. And we arrived at the stadium where the record was set by Dylan. And Dylan had jumped, I think, 19 cars. He jumped 19 cars there. And a year later, a very famous motocross rider by the name of Ian Topless got pulled in. I think Dylan was injured at the time. And Ian Topless came in and actually jumped 20. And so the record was 20 cars. And I was like, well, man, I mean, if there's a record, I've got to break this thing. And we put in the 21st car. And I still remember running up to the ramp thinking, what are you doing? You know, this is not a motocross rider, really. These are top. I mean, Ian Topless is one of the biggest names in motocross in South Africa. And he just jumped 20. Here's this trials guy, too big for the bike, made zero sense. The laws of physics just didn't make sense. But I guess where there's a will, there's a way. And yeah, I broke the record that day in the same stadium that it was broken the year, well, made, you know, created the year before.
And that record still stands, to your knowledge?
I'm led to believe. Somebody said some kid jumped 25 cars at Kings Park Stadium on a 125. And I mean, it just doesn't. There's zero chance. I mean, a 125 would just never be able to. First of all, the Kings Park Stadium is half the size of the stadium that I jumped, you know, the record in. And then, you know, to jump it on a 125, just it's not possible. I mean, they're dreaming. So I'm led to believe it stands.
We want to see proof, guys, whoever that was. If you're listening, send us the video. Yeah, but then you went and did something equally as crazy, but this time in Australia. And that's one thing that always fascinates me about Australia. I was there a couple of months back, and, you know, the top headlines in newspapers are that they're wanting to ban kids from doing cartwheels in schools because they're injuring their wrists, but then they allow people to do some completely crazy stuff like jump 20 cars in Australia. How did you manage to connect your car jumping record from SA all the way to Australia?
Well, Doug, that's an interesting point that you say there. You know that there's a saying that goes, it's better to ask for forgiveness than for permission. So I'm not too sure on whether they gave us permission to do that, but we did it. And the funny thing about the story is actually that it wasn't such a cool story at the time. I actually got booed out of the stadium.
Oh, no way.
They were not happy with me, man. I'd broken their Glory Boys record. You know, he had jumped 19 and the stadium was only big enough to jump 20. And I'd broken the record, man. And this was some little snot nose from South Africa coming and chowing their rider, and they weren't happy, bro. I promise you, they really booed me out of the stadium. I rode out with my tail between my legs. I was supposed to be a hero.
When was that, BC? What year?
That was in 2000. I spent 6 months in Australia touring with the Monster Truck Show, with the Bigfoot Monster Truck Show, and it was my first show there. The very first night we got to there in a town called Bunbury. And I got booed right out of the stadium. It was the craziest of things. I would have thought that I'd be a hero.
And especially in Bunbury, because cheap as there are a lot of South Africans, or perhaps hadn't all moved there yet.
Yeah, this is 11 years ago, Doug. No, 20 years ago. What am I talking about? Sorry.
Exactly. No, it's crazy, man. It's absolutely crazy. Okay, well, that record probably still stands too. So, yeah, sorry, Aussies, you got to get better, man. Got to get better, guys. So you've another incredible feat that you managed to nail down, and was just before my time at the Bull. But what on earth possessed you to ride over the arch at Moses Mbida Stadium? I mean, I'm a KZN guy, and I spent a good few years living in Durban on the Berea. I'd look down and onto Moses Mbida Stadium almost every single day for the better part of 4 years. And I must say, every single time I looked at that, I thought, can you believe Brian Kapp has ridden over that thing? Who came up with that idea, and how did you actually plan on executing it?
That's another good question. I was actually doing a show at a nightclub over the road from the stadium. You'd probably know it. I can't remember what it was called. Was it called 80s?
80s, yeah, definitely. 80s was an institution. It's pretty much where everyone used to go after watching the Sharks, right next to the stadium.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I was there for. I guess it must have been, I don't know, 11 or 12 at night, at midnight. And I'd been asked by Red Bull to do a ride through the nightclub, and jumped onto the bar counter with a bike. It was a pretty cool thing. But when I rode out, they were building the stadium, obviously, for the World Cup. And I don't know what made me do it, man, but I looked at this thing and I thought, how crazy would that be to ride a bike over this thing? But I had mentioned it to a friend of mine at the time who was somehow involved. I don't know how he got access to it, but he'd somehow been close to it. And he just said to me, he said, Brian, when you get close to it, man, you cannot believe how steep it is. And it was all cornered off. I think you'll remember at the time it was super high security around the thing. Anyway, long story short, at 1 o'clock in the morning after doing the show, I actually broke into the place to go and actually physically walk up this thing and see, you know, how steep it was. And I remember getting closer and closer and closer to it and thinking, are you out of your mind to even think that you're going to be able to ride over this thing? I mean, just the magnitude of how big and steep that thing is, just it blew my mind. I was like, there's just no ways.
Well, it's big enough. It's big enough to the point where people have literally done base jumps. When Nitro Circus came to South Africa, the opening act were people base jumping off the arch. That just proves how high it is.
That's right. Yep.
So in terms of your preparation for that now, I mean, how do you go about doing that? You've talked about how steep it is, but it's obviously a stair set that runs clean from one side to the other. What was the more technical aspect to it? Was it the climb up to the top or was it the descent down the other side?
It was both. And I mean, I've been asked that so many times and I always harp on the fact that the down was worse than the up. But to be honest with you, and I've never ever told the story, you're the first person or the first podcast that I've been on that I've actually really told the truth to this story. But the down was more scary and dangerous only from a point of view because I lost my brakes halfway down.
Well, they just overheated.
The heat generation was so big for those little brakes on those trials bikes that it just couldn't cope with the sheer volume of heat that was being, you know, transferred into them. And so that was the scary thing. And I was having to go from front brake to rear brake to engine braking. It was hectic, man. But obviously the more scary thing was going up, because if the bike looped out and I fell backwards down those stairs, there's just no way. I mean, we just kept rolling all the way to the bottom. And I mean, it's gnarly, dude. You've actually, someone that's never been there, you actually need to go there and go and walk up those stairs. It's 550 stairs. And so people say to me, how did you practice that? And there's actually no way of practicing it. The only way that I could do it was to mentally visualize it. I spent 3 months mentally visualizing going up these stairs and just staying on track and just keep going, keep going, keep going. Because you think about it, where have you ever seen a set of stairs more than maybe 40 or 50 stairs in one direction?
No, it's absolutely crazy. And those were steel stairs too. So I don't imagine your traction would have been all that good either. Your time of day, the weather itself on the day. I mean, being in Durban though, you've got that humidity you have to deal with close to the sea, probably, you know, a bit of salty grime on it. I mean, how did you prepare for that? Did you at least do any testing on that in terms of grip and what you'd need to run your tire pressures at, which tires to run?
Yeah, that's look, the tire pressures is a pretty standard tire pressure. You know, you've got to run them pretty soft to get the maximum grip. But just going back to what you were saying about the time of the day, the weather conditions, we actually shot the actual video at 5 a.m. in the morning, which made absolutely no sense because there was no spectator viewership. It wasn't a public thing. It was all for a video, to shoot the video, you know. So it was a pretty crazy time of the day because it was windy, abnormally windy, and if that wasn't enough, then there was a chopper flying next to my head, going the whole way up it. So you know, there were many things, but on the grip side, we were really fortunate because the guards actually for the swing, they do that bridge swing thing there, they've actually got like grip tape on, it's almost like a sandpaper,
yeah,
on the actual stairs. So that was really cool. I'll tell you where the tricky part came in was these stairs were stainless steel stairs or aluminium stairs. So they were bolted to the actual concrete structure. And one of the things that I was concerned about was that these things were going to vibrate loose because something that no one knows is we actually did the run twice. The first one, we were just blown away that we'd actually made it. The second one, we thought, let's just shoot an extra one in case. But on the second run, I was worried that potentially some of the stairs had moved. And so that pushed us out about 2 hours. We had to, you know, make adjustments and just check that all the stairs were tight. So there's so many of these things that you don't know, you know, at the time. But weather played a big role that day because it was abnormally windy. And we actually thought about canning it at one stage. It was so windy.
Well, yeah, those types of environments, you're not exactly wanting to take more risk than is necessary. And yeah, that was truly incredible. If you want to go and check it out, folks, I think head over to Red Bull TV or just even Google search Brian Kappa Moses Mabhida Stadium. It's incredible. I did see you were on a road trip somewhere. I think it might have been a year or two ago that you came across another little arch on one of your trips and you were like, hey, pulled over on the side of the road, offloaded your bike, zipped over the thing. Where was that?
That was actually a really cool one, man, because, you know, obviously the one for Moses Mabhida was super planned out. It was, you know, huge contracts in place, public liabilities, you name it, you know, film crews. It was insane the amount of effort that the guys, the crew put together there. But this one, I was on my way back from a show. I'm not actually even sure, but it was like Wombard's Way. It was on the Polokwane Highway. And I saw this thing on the way to the show and thought, flip, man, I wonder if that would be possible, you know, to do this with no, you know, no planning, no crew, no nothing. Just stop on the side of the road, literally put my phone on the other side of this arch and put my, I think it was a GoPro or TomTom at the time on my helmet. And just ride over this thing, man. It was the coolest flipping thing. I'll never forget the cars driving past. I mean, halfway up this thing, I looked down at the highway and the guys were just hooting and going crazy. They were like, are you out of your mind? It was cool.
Well, they I think that is a good question. I think it is a good question because there was no safety, no backup, just Brian and the challenge.
Yeah, not that there was a backup or a safety on the other one either, by the way. The one at Moses Mabhida, there was no, you know, people say to me, where was the cable? Because, you know, when you walk up there, they won't allow you to walk up there without a harness on. And so, you know, they were like, no, we got to tie this harness to you. And I said, are you joking, bro? There's no ways that that's going to be possible. You know, first of all, the Moses Mabhida one, I would love to have ridden on the actual railing. But the film of aluminium is so thin that you can just stick your hand right through it. It's just for aesthetics. It just makes it look good. So we had to actually ride on the stairs.
Surely the aluminium though would have been too slippery.
Possibly. Remembering that it's concrete for probably, I'd say 30 meters or 25 meters up, and then it goes onto the aluminium. And by then I'd figured out that I'd had it all planned out that I thought that if I get enough momentum on the concrete, I should be able to have enough momentum on the aluminium to not have to now still try and accelerate even harder. You know, I thought that I could probably get enough momentum. And if worst came to worst, I could always jump onto the staircase. The problem was if wind blew me to the right, it was game over, you know, so...
Maybe he would have had to be wearing a base jumping parachute just in case.
That would have been cool, but I wouldn't have wanted to test that though.
Fair enough, man. So in terms of rubbing shoulders, I mean, you've done so much of the sport locally, you've raced abroad and so on, but you've also spent some time at Pastrana Land. Tell us a little bit about what that was like, because I also believe you're the first person to pull off a backflip on a trials bike at Pastrana Land.
Yeah, this story might take a little longer than expected, but there's not many people that can say that they went and spent, you know, 2 weeks staying at his house. But we were racing a supermoto race. It was in 2004. I only did two rounds that year. I did one in Copper Lake, Colorado, and the second one was in Nashville, Tennessee, of all places. And it was the biggest thing to hit supermoto because Travis at the time was the hugest thing in supercross and in freestyle motocross. And he decided as well, just a phenomenon in terms of motorsport. The guy, just anything he touches turns to gold, literally. And he decided to come and do the supermoto round down in Nashville, Tennessee. And in my first heat race, he had qualified third and I'd qualified fourth. And so the first four are on the front row. So it was, I think it was Jeff Ward on pole, Doug Henry second, you know, TP third, myself fourth. And I'll never forget it. This is a cool story, but I'll never forget. We're on the line. I mean, this is my dream coming true. I'm getting to race against the best in the world. I'm racing next to Travis Pastrana. And I'd met him in the morning. And I remember him knocking my left arm, because obviously it goes left to right. And he knocked my left arm, which is the clutch arm. And the lights were on, man. We were ready to race. And he looked across at me, hit my arm and said, "Hey, Kappa, do you breathe in or do you breathe out when the lights go green?" And that was our race. You know, he the little biscuit, he actually managed to get the jump on me, because obviously now I was thinking, you know, in or out, you know, breathe in or breathe out. But we ended up having a cool heat race. And the week after that, I think it was Hurricane Katrina or one of those. And the next round was canceled. And I'll never forget him saying to me, I gave him a call. He gave me a call. It was something happening. I was in his area. I was staying with a friend in Maryland. In Washington, and he said to me, he said, "Listen, dude, you know, we've got this bad weather coming in, but I've got this huge warehouse and we've got indoor foam pits and this and that. Listen, if you want to come and hang out, pull in, you know." And I was like, "Are you joking?" And I was there within, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours drive. I was down at his place. And yeah, man, it was really, really cool. It was cool to live in a guy's home that is passionate on another level in terms of motorsport and just pushing everything to the extreme. I mean, it was the most incredible 2 weeks of my life.
So in terms of spending time there, of course, and rubbing shoulders with all those kinds of guys is one thing, but riding with them as well, did you learn anything? Did you improve as a rider? How was that whole experience and the dynamic?
Yeah, it was really cool, because the guys that were there all hit the road when the weather came. And the main reason was that he loves riding in the woods and he loves GNCC enduro type riding, but he had no one to ride with him. And so that was the coolest thing for me, was that he really was excited and stoked for, you know, for a guy that was able to be able to ride at that level with him. And so that was cool. I rode, you know, he was on his factory RM250. I was a privateer from a supermoto point of view at the time, so I could ride anything. So I jumped on his, you know, on his spare bikes, and man, we just had a blast for 2 weeks. We rode in the forests and the woods, banging bars. He's an animal. I mean, whether he's in a supercross race or just practicing in the woods, he's on the line and everything's on the line. He is just wide open all the time. So that was cool, and I'll never forget it. We were practicing backflips into the foam pit. He's got a huge foam pit. He actually uses airbags now. The airbag works better now than the foam pit. But we were practicing backflips into the foam pit, and I was honestly getting 20 out of 20 perfectly on the wheels. And so I'll never forget the one morning. I don't know. It must have been 5:30 in the morning, pouring with rain. I just heard this bobcat outside. I look out my window and there's Travis building this huge landing ramp out of very soft sand and wooden chips. So anyway, I go downstairs and I go outside to him. I'm like, "Bro, what are you doing?" He said, "No, I'm building you a landing. We're going to do the backflip today on a trials bike." He had a Sherco trials bike at the time. And none of his buddies could ride this thing, including him. They had no clue how to ride this thing. And so when I jumped on this thing and did my thing, he was blown away. He was like, "Dude, we've never seen anyone ride one of these things like this before." And he said, "No, come, we've got to get this backflip onto dirt. And if you are, you'll be the first guy to ever do it on a, you know, on a trials bike." Anyway, long story short, if you go and look at the Nitro Circus DVD range, if anyone still remembers what a DVD is, you'll see there that on Nitro Circus 2, the actual backflip was on that video. He made me look like a tool though, because he actually, the first one I did perfectly, the second one I landed perfectly, the third one I was overconfident, over rotated, and crashed on my backside. And he played that one first in the video, obviously to spice things up, you know, to make it look
yeah,
you know, I didn't make the first one, but I actually landed the first one, which was pretty cool. First two actually.
Oh, there we go, some inside scoop. That's pretty rad. Yeah, jeepers. I mean, just another tick box, I guess, for you in terms of your overall career. But let's bring it back home now. I mean, you're still racing, you're still loving it. Inner City Enduro, we know that you love mixing it up there. Had a bit of a controversial run a couple of years back, but it seems as though that this local, like, inner city racing, so to speak, all these extremes are doing pretty well in South Africa. But the broader question I want to ask now is, what are your views on where the sport's at in South Africa at the moment? And I'm not talking about any particular version of it. I'm talking like, yeah, actually, maybe I am focusing on off-road two-wheel motorsport. Where do you think it is in South Africa, and where do you think it's going in the next 3 to 5 years?
Doug, that's a tough question to answer. The problem, unfortunately, is, and I certainly don't want to be doom and gloom, but with the Euro going to 20 or almost 21 now, that it's hurting the bike sales bad. The industry is very reliant on, you know, more and more, I don't want to say weekend warriors, but the average guys. You know, there's only 10 Wade Youngs in this country. When I say that, all due respect, there's only one Wade Young, but there's only 10 top pros that are really able to do this full time. The rest of the guys, I mean, you go to a national enduro or national off-road and there's 300 to 400 riders, only the top 10 or top 15 are doing this full time. The rest of the sport is completely weekend riders, you know, guys doing this socially. And so that is making it very tough. You know, the top 10 or 15 guys are going to get free motorbikes, whether the Euro is at 10 to 1 or 20 to 1, they're going to get free bikes. But the weekend riders, that's going to be the sign of things to come now, you know, whether they're going to be able to keep upgrading their bikes and doing that. So as far as the sport is concerned, the level is crazy at the moment. The level is so high that the riding level is, it really has gone crazy. Where do I see it in 3 to 5 years' time? I can't answer that right now, Doug. I'd like to believe it's going to be strong, because if I look at the talent coming through, the young riders, it's going to be really, really good. My worry is that I'm wondering if the dads are going to be able to afford it. And, you know, that unfortunately is going to be based on what the economy does.
Yeah, of course. I think the two are linked, but I also think that people adapt in the way that they spend their money in many respects. So we've seen similar challenges in mountain biking over the last 5 years, because as you said earlier, I mean, a mountain bike, you want a top-end mountain bike versus a top-end race bike. And when I mean like a motorbike, when I say top-end, I'm certainly not talking factory-level bikes here. I'm talking about, you walk into the Yamaha or KTM and so on, you can go and buy a very beautiful 300 two-stroke to go and ride enduro, and you are looking at a very similar price point to a mountain bike, more often than not less than a mountain bike.
You're right.
What we've seen in the mountain biking space, though, is that guys are just keeping their stuff for longer. They're being a lot more methodical about making sure their gear is maintained and they're looking after things. You know, guys washing their bikes almost after every ride now. So I'm hoping that the trend will be the same, and that it doesn't really impact the sport in terms of participation. It just changes the way people buy things and how long they have them for. So where we saw in mountain biking, guys would traditionally replace their bike every 12 months. Now they're replacing their bike maybe every 24 months. Perhaps if they go over 24, they'll keep the frame, but they'll do potentially new suspension. You know, drivetrains, as we both know, you know, generally if you ride often, you need 2 drivetrains a year. So that's neither really here nor there. But the expensive parts, the frames, the suspension, they rather upgrade those things than be going on a whole new rig. So I'm hoping it's the same for two-wheel motorsport, or at least enduro riding here in South Africa. Because, I mean, if I look at the landscape of it now, I was chatting about this with Wade and even Kirsten Landman the other night, is, you know, that MP series in KZN is very strong. The Matatu Pont is sold out. You know, all of these events now seem like they're really starting to gain momentum, where mountain biking was the thing 10 years ago. It almost feels like it's going more the enduro, adventure, enduro direction now.
Yeah, these weekends away are really a big thing. You know, not necessarily a race. It doesn't need to be a race, but these low felt races are really, really doing well. These guys have really got the recipe right. the KZN series used to be the strongest series, but they've lost the plot somewhere along the line. I'm not sure what the WFO guys have done or the KZN Hoyer Scramble guys, but their numbers are not as high as they were. I'm led to believe. I might be wrong. But I know that these Lowveld guys are really doing a good job. I know that Lawrence Mahoney's series that he had before, the GXCC series, was rocking and rolling. They were having 400, 450, 500 riders at a race. I mean, those are big, big numbers. I think that the guys are starting to look at these events that are three-day events where they're going more on a social adventure. The guys are really getting attracted to that. You know, they're not necessarily held hostage to racing against the clock or racing against someone else. They want to do more of these social events, you know, where they can have a couple of beers afterwards and help each other up and down these rock steps. And, you know, it really is becoming like an adventure.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm finding it quite fascinating because, I mean, obviously, you know, during my time in the corporate world at Red Bull and seeing how, you know, everyone was incredibly focused, especially working with athletes like yourself and the rest of the portfolio there. I mean, generally everyone there is at the top of their game, or if not quite there yet, very shortly afterwards, they were at the top of their game. But in terms of the mass participation in sports now, and it's not just in enduro, for example, it's in trail running, it's in triathlon, it's in mountain biking, it's even in road cycling, where you're starting to see numbers at events coming under pressure. So your like race participation in terms of entries is declining, but people aren't riding any less. They're still out there and riding. They're just riding on their own terms. Because if you're someone like myself who started mountain biking, for argument's sake, 5 years ago, I never entered into the sport because I wanted to race the thing. I'm way too tall for it. I just love riding my bike, and I love the personal challenge of trying to ride 3 to 4 times a week. And, you know, it took me 6 months to build up to hitting the full jump line on the downhill course in Takai, and I was chuffed, man. I was like, the sense of achievement I got out of that was far more than I have out of any mountain bike race that I've ever done. But within that, it's going back to the conversation we're having just now about how people afford to do things, because ultimately what that speaks to, if you're not racing all the time, you're not putting your equipment under that hard racing conditions all the time, you're not pushing the envelope, you're not damaging things, you're not having to repair and maintain things at the same level, perhaps that's going to be the saving grace for the sport, where people are more inclined to ride as a group with 10 or 15 mates, go and book an awesome place to stay and head out into the forests for 2-3 days back to back. You know, they're looking after their bikes every evening. They're not pushing it more the bikes to the max. It's more pushing their skill set to the max. I'm hoping that it goes that direction.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct. And I mean, I'll tell you where I see that really getting big now is the guys are now phoning me. I'm getting more and more inquiries now to do group rides, to take guys out and do, you know, more extreme type rides, but not in a racing environment. And so, you know, my rider training, my coaching academy has gone crazy. You know, there's the guys really are guys that are playing golf, that were playing golf on a Wednesday afternoon, are now coming for riding lessons with me. And they're saying, listen, on a Wednesday afternoon, I'm guaranteed a hard ride. I've got a guy that's going to show me the ropes exactly like I need to do it. And, you know, I'm getting a much better workout than what I'm getting at golf. So I do see that the social side of these sports, or of our sport anyway, and in any sport for that matter, you know, when I say that, I mean, mountain biking, you know, motorsport, whatever it is, I think that the social side is really, these social events are gonna rock and roll.
Yeah, ultimately, though, that speaks to sports maturing and becoming sustainable, because it's an equation that I draw to the sport of surfing. If you look at surfing globally, it's arguably one of the most, like the highest participatory non-mainstream sports. Like wherever there is an ocean and a wave and a city or a town, generally there are going to be surfers there. And yet if you look at the global surfing competition or level of competition, there's only probably 1,000 to 2,000 surfers that compete across the different levels of events. So like the qualifying series of the World Surf League and so on. But that's not what drives the sport. What drives the sport is the guy, as you said earlier on, like the weekend warrior, the guy that owns one or two boards, that's buying a new wetsuit every year, that's buying some booties, you know, that's wearing the Quicksilver gear when he's off the water, that actually is the person that enables the sport to survive. And I really hope that mountain biking and also talking about enduro motorsport is that will be the case as well, where it's not the top end of the sport being responsible for maintaining the sport, or at least putting it in a position where it can survive. Because I'm also of the view that, you know, top athletes get put under unnecessary pressure where they are seen to be responsible for the sport sometimes. Events as well, you know, people think, you know, you hear questions like, well, why isn't this event doing this for the sport? And why isn't that event doing that for the sport? And my argument is, it's not the athletes, nor is it in terms of the pros, nor is it the event's responsibility to be building the sport. That's the job of MSA or Canoeing South Africa or Cycling South Africa. That's their job. The event is more of a platform for you to express yourself, to have a good time, to make memories. If you're a professional, it's your working environment where you go out there to do your sponsors proud and achieve the results. And so, yeah, I think that mindset as well is also changing on how the model of sports, especially in South Africa, becomes sustainable.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole another topic. You know, you say that it should be those organizations that are supposed to be building those sports, but unfortunately, they're not. So I don't know in the kayaking world, but in motorsport South Africa is doing nothing. So, you know, and I can say that now because I don't compete competitively anymore. So I don't care if they don't give me a license. But you know, the reality is that it is up to us now. It is up to maybe not. Well, I mean, I guess Wade Young. You know, a guy like Wade Young is still, you know, he's representing the sport, so he's the showcase of it. But I mean, I guess that's up to guys like me now that are not necessarily on the front line all the time like that anymore, but able to bring the sport to the people now. And I mean, obviously through my shows I do that. I'm a brand ambassador for all these companies now. I'm not a sponsored athlete for these guys now. I'm a brand ambassador now. So now I'm bringing all these sports and events to the people, but I'm not necessarily competing anymore. So, like you say, I think it's going to be with social media and times are changing, man. I mean, we're seeing now with this coronavirus, we're seeing that, you know, people are having to adapt. They're having to just change things up and adapt with times. I mean, who would ever have seen this coming along? Who would ever have seen a shutdown come like this? And you know, now is the time where we all got to think outside the box. This is where we've got to really, really, this is, you're going to make it or break it now, man. This is, you know, we've got to push the limits and live life to the max, man. We've got to get things going and rock and roll.
Yeah, completely agree. In terms of in other sports, but it's for the most part the same. Hey, Brian, it's if you look at various federations and the way that they operate in supporting athletes and events and those types of things, there's not a hell of a lot of action that happens here in South Africa, and that's across the board. It just is what it is. And what's quite interesting, and I mean, it's still bikes, but it's not motorbikes. But in the cycling space, you know, you look at events like the Cape Town Cycle Tour. That's not sanctioned with CSA. That's through Pedal Power Association, because Pedal Power Association had a different approach to doing things, had a fallout with CSA, it went legal, and I don't know the ins and outs of it, but essentially Pedal Power won, and they were able to form their own independent organization free of what Cycling South Africa offered. But essentially, if you want to start a mountain bike race, you have to be sanctioned by CSA, and that is part of the constitution and what they dictate. But when it comes to a National Events Act, you don't necessarily need to do that. And what's been quite interesting is there's a breakaway group of events here in South Africa that have said, cool, CSA, we don't need you and we actually don't want you. Because one thing that's also different in the sport of mountain biking and cycling is that a lot of these events are privately owned and they're run as businesses. Now, if you have a gathering of more than 300 people, you fall under having to abide by the National Events Act. And the National Events Act, for the most part, is far more comprehensive than what a sportive body requires in terms of standards that you execute at an event. I mean, that's the law of the country. The National Events Act is what you fall under. So you hear of these events in the cycling world where CSA comes out and says, oh, well, any CSA sanctioned rider that rides in that event is then going to be banned from riding any other CSA events, the national colors and so on and so forth. But for me, they missed the point entirely, because 95% of the rider base doesn't care if they get banned from CSA events because they probably don't ride them anyway. And the event organizers are saying, cool guys, but we're now abiding to the National Events Act, which means now we've got this security in place, these medical teams in place, X, Y, and Z, public liabilities, they're all taking it out themselves. And where CSA, for the most part, now has not got really any stick to hold to beat them with, because their fallback used to be, well, when you're sanctioned with CSA, you get public liability cover for your athletes and your riders. And, you know, this event isn't sanctioned with us, so therefore you probably aren't going to get the same level of service and security and safety, when in fact now the reality is that you often get better. But yeah, that's mountain biking. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's where things end up going in a few more sports.
I wouldn't be surprised. And again, times are changing, man. It might be the perfect time for something new and fresh to come in.
Yeah.
You know, everything evolving, you know. Who knows? Times, exciting times, I think. You know, you can either look at this and stick your head in the ground and go, oh, we doomed, or you can go, man, this is a time for opportunity, man. I hope some new, exciting and interesting stuff comes out of this, you know.
I think it already is. And we will get through this. I think it's going to be a bit of a longer haul than people expect. I think people are celebrating that coming out of Corona in 21 days. I mean, this podcast now, if you're listening to it now, for the most part, I'm hoping Corona has passed us. But yeah, I think it's going to be a slightly longer journey. But as you say, I think people will adapt and they'll adapt for the better. And before we kind of start to head towards wrapping up here, Brian, tell us a little bit more about your training academy. If guys want to get involved and take advantage of your endless reserve of knowledge and training ability.
Yeah, I mean it's part of the next step for me. You know, passing on my knowledge to hopefully the next big thing. You know, if we could find a couple more Wade Youngs or, you know, a couple more hotshot riders worldwide, it'd be nice if they came out of my stable. But you know, I'm just really enjoying not having the pressure of racing week in, week out. And one of the ways that I'm able to still stay in shape and still keep my eye in is riding as much as I'm riding. I'm probably riding more now than what I was riding when I was racing full time. And I'm not even exaggerating.
Wow.
I've got permanent guys. I do a lot of one-on-one training. I do 2 days of the week where I do slightly bigger groups, but the rest of the days are one-on-one. So the guys are getting real individual attention. And I want to say most of my customer base is, you know, preparing for the Roof of Africa. The guys are really taking the Roof of Africa seriously. And so I help the guys, you know, in the right direction with that, you know, eating right, training right, the correct, you know, training on the bike, preparation leading up to the race, you know, when to peak, when not to peak, you know, what to put in your bum bag, what to have at different times. You know, I'm putting a lot of my guys on trials bikes now, motocross and enduro guys. I'm putting them on trials bikes. So, you know, the guys that I'm coaching for the Roof will come to me one day a week for enduro training. And if they've got a day on the weekend when I don't have a show or a race, they'll come for a trial session. So the guys are taking it seriously. I mean, they're spending money on the equipment, on getting the right, you know, getting the additional bikes and stuff. But yeah, I mean, getting back to the question, how do the guys get involved? I mean, it's pretty simple. I'm not very difficult to get hold of. I'm on Instagram, Facebook. You know, all my numbers are on there. So it's a matter of just getting hold of me, sending me a private message and get hold of me and see when we can find a gap. The biggest thing is to find a gap in the schedule to slot the guys in. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. So yeah, it's going well. It's exciting. And, you know, if I can get the guys to do the sport correctly, I think we're going in the right direction. If I can teach people how to ride safely, I think that the sport is in a good way going forward.
Final question from me is, when are we going to see BC in a Dakar car giving it horns?
That's a big question. Are you offering, is Wild Air TV happy to put their name on the side of the 10 million rand car that we're going to purchase and then another 10 to go and race Dakar? Or?
Yeah, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. Definitely not yet, BC, but I hope in 10 years time, maybe. But yeah, I mean, jokes aside, would that ever be, if you got offered the opportunity to give it a mix or mix it up there, would you accept it?
120%. Man, the car racing for me is such a, I've got such a love for that sport, man, because it's racing a motocross until you've done it. And I think you actually have. I think you've been with Alfie or with Janelle. Man, if you haven't tasted that adrenaline rush that you get from racing wide open through the bush with a big cage around you, man, you cannot get hurt in that thing. That is the coolest thing about that sport, is that you are racing at ridiculous speeds over crazy terrain, and you're not going to get hurt. So would I do it? Man, I would love to do it. To do it on a bike, I don't think those the level that you've got to ride at now. I mean, I had a chat to Sam Sunderland when I was in Qatar, and he just said to me, he said, "Brian, you're going over crests wide open at 160 k's an hour and just hoping that there's not a blind rise or a corner at the end of it." And there's just the chances of you dying in that race are huge. And unfortunately for me right now at this point in my life, I don't want to do that anymore. I've done that for many years, but if the opportunity came along in a car, man, I would love it. People don't know this about me. This is something that a lot of people don't know, is that I actually drive a car better than I ride a bike. On a serious note, my skills in a car or in four wheels are better than on two wheels. Unfortunately, you need a huge, huge, huge bank balance or a sponsor that really, really loves you.
Yeah, for sure. Fair enough. Awesome. Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us here at Something Fresh. An absolute privilege to have you on the show. Thank you for taking us through your life's journey so far. Hopefully we can connect with you again a few times during the year to catch up on your journey. And it's just been a really insightful conversation. Anything you want to say to wrap it up?
Yeah, two more things from my side. Just a huge thank you to you guys for having me on here. It's guys like you guys that really keep sportsmen alive in this country. And so, huge thanks to you. You guys are doing great things. I follow your, what you guys are doing. And obviously, a lot of your stuff is about mountain biking, which I've got a huge passion for. I love the sport. I just want to put something out there, and I don't know if this is the right place to put it, but I'm going to give it a go anyway. One of my bucket list things to do is to do the doozy. And I know that Travis Teasdale did it last year, I think, and I know Kirsty did it this year. But I know you're in that game and you speak to a lot of the guys, but if there's anyone that ever is looking for someone to sit in the back of the boat, I don't normally sit in the back. I'm normally on the front. But I know that that river as well as you guys do. But if there was ever the opportunity to be in that thing and give it a go, I wouldn't mind putting that on my list of things that I've done.
Consider it done, man. No problems. You're in for 2021.
Good.
That'd be awesome. Okay. Well, thanks, BC. We'll keep in touch. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Something Fresh, where we speak to innovators, athletes, and progressive thinkers. That, of course, was motorsport legend Brian Kappa, and wishing him well with his further endeavors. Until next time, stay safe, everybody. Cheers.